Hi, I'm Dan Cottrell, editor of Rugby Coach Weekly. You're about to jump into one of our podcasts. If you want to find out more about this podcast and also all of the great content, drills, activities, games and advice on the website, then go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
If you look at what the PWR done this year in terms of that big campaign that they produced at the start of the season, and Powered Differently was their slogan. They're trying to get across that message that women are wired differently to men, and it's those sort of female differences that deserve to be celebrated and bigged up as much as possible.
Be the best rugby coach you can be. Welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with head coach Dan Cottrell, where you learn hints and tips from the rugby coaching community. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with me, Dan Cottrell. I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast Fiona Thomas. I hope I've said that, pronounced that correctly.
You've said it better than most people, Dan. Don't worry.
Okay. Well, started in the right space. So Fiona is the women's support sports reporter at The Telegraph, and we're going to chat about women's sports and a bit about women's rugby. So the first question I'm going to ask is about rugby and what attracts women to rugby.
Oh, wow. Great first question, Dan. Quite broad. I guess from a sort of, when you strip it all back from a grassroots perspective, when you've got 15 players in a team, I would say that from a female perspective, it's the fact that rugby is a game for all shapes and sizes. We know historically that teenage girls and women, even into adulthood, suffer or experience things like body image insecurities. And, you know, rugby as a team sport, you know, there's a place for everyone on the pitch, regardless of, you know, what size you are, what weight you are, how you might look. And I genuinely do believe that that is a really big drawing point for a lot of women and girls who come to the game, or even, you know, just a fans of the game. If you look at, I guess, sports, other female team sports such as netball, it's generally accepted that you've got to be quite tall to play that game if you're a woman. Football, I would argue, you know, I mean, women's football has exploded, hasn't it, in the past 5-7 years. But I would argue that athletically, from a body physique perspective, you know, the 11 players across any one women's football team, maybe bar the goalkeeper, are generally kind of very similar in their sort of physique. And, you know, that's where sort of rugby sort of stands out a bit from the pack. And we know from a women's community rugby perspective, we've got a lot of women and girls come to the game at university level. You know, they come to the sport late because historically the pathways just haven't been there for women and girls. So yeah, there's obviously the social element of it as well with camaraderie, and that's where the strong sort of university base can also play a big role. So
it's interesting that you talk about when they come to rugby, you're talking about body image. So when a lot of boys start rugby, they will start rugby 6, 7, 8, 9, and girls at that age, one assumes that body image is not something which is forefront of their mind because of all the things that they're exposed to. But later on, maybe when they're 15, 16, 17, they're far more conscious of it. So do you think that's why they do come late to the game, because they see it as the alternative?
Partly, I guess. Yeah, I mean, what you've got to remember is that, you know, teenagers, whether you're a girl or a boy, you know, you go through a lot of change, don't you, during puberty. And for women, you know, guys generally kind of shoot up and have that kind of growth spurt. And for women, it's, you know, suddenly your hips spring out of nowhere. You know, you've got all this bodily hair. You might not want to, like, show off your legs in a changing room. You know, you have periods to deal with. And there's a lot of change. And that change can be very kind of unsettling. And that's why there is such a, you know, participation gap when it comes to, you know, community sport in this country, as charities such as Women in Sport have historically identified. And it can take time if you're a woman to sort of get over all those bodily changes, process them, and then realize when you kind of reach kind of the end of your teens, going into adulthood, that actually, women are finding that they gravitate back towards sport and that sort of joy from playing sport. And I think that genuinely is a sort of trodden path for a lot of women. I know a lot of my friends have certainly, they wouldn't have dreamed going anywhere near a rugby pitch age 14, 15, 16, and suddenly, they're early 20s and they're playing week in, week out for a local club, and it's awesome to see.
So, generally, again, I mean, you don't associate women with rough and tumble, where boys will fight and girls won't necessarily do that. So, why again are they then attracted to something which is turns out to be quite physical when they're bumping into each other, which is not something that they've necessarily been used to in other parts of their lives?
Oh, you'd have to ask them, I guess. It's just like, some women love contact, don't they? I think what we've got to remember is that society has always sort of painted women and girls as, the fairer sex who, can't handle the rough and tumble, like you say. Like, why would they want to get muddy on a rugby pitch and, be all unfeminine, for want of a better word? But I think what we're seeing more and more with the growth of women's rugby, from a community perspective, especially in this country, we are seeing rugby clubs embrace women playing the sport, and it's taken a while to get there, but I think we are kind of reaching that place where women and girls are feeling valued and supported now, and given the sort of license to grow, in, let's face it, environments that have always been, for men. So
No,
yeah, it's
talking about environments for men then. So obviously you are writing about sports, one of the major newspapers in the UK, if not the world. And generally, women's sport has not played a big part in it. It's growing. You've been part of the move to sort of have specials around women's sport. Do these articles need to be written differently? Do they need to be written from a feminine point of view, or do they need to be written from a sports point of view? What's the sense of the direction?
It's an interesting question. I often find that when I cover, a team like the Red Roses, time and time again, you ask yourself, well, what does my reader already know about the Red Roses? How big are they yet? Because, let's face it, women's rugby, it hasn't been on on free-to-air TV for ages, like, men's international rugby has, and we are still sort of right at the starting point in a way. I mean, we have seen the growth of the game come on leaps and bounds, haven't we, and the coverage of it. But, if you scratch below the surface of the Red Roses sort of level domestically with Premiership Women's Rugby, as it was formerly called, the Premier 15s, that is still sort of, battling for airtime on kind of a mainstream channel. We've got the TNT deal now with TNT Sports. But yeah, it's I'm sort of digressing from your question, I guess.
Well, but
From
I just want to go back in a sense that when you, I mean, and what you've said is about the space that it has and whether the audience actually understands what you're saying. But I'm very interested to know whether when you write an article about women's sport or even talk about it, whether language has to change. I mean, obviously, there is some subtlety in you talk about you talk about women rather than men and she rather than he and that sort of thing. But what do you have to change the style of language? Does it have to be more feminine, or does it have to be about sport in order to attract readers to the sport?
I guess you do have to be a bit more nuanced sometimes, especially when you're talking about or writing about women. For example, one of my bugbears is that I would never use terminology that is sort of inherently female when kind of describing how a game of rugby is being played. For example, if Ellie Kildan, the Red Roses and Harlequins fullback, was to sort of, sigh through a sea of bodies, 50-meter run in for a try, I would resist using, I would resist writing something like, oh yeah, and Ellie Kildon danced her way through the defense, because I think that automatically kind of carries very kind of feminine connotations, and it's sort of, well, yeah, women love to dance, men love to dance, but when we're talking about a game of rugby here, what kind of language do you really want to use to really get across how strong and physical and how just bloody brilliant these athletes are? So it's stuff like that, I guess, which, I guess it's second nature to me. I don't really think about it anymore. But I 100% get your point about
So I'm thinking about the audience, you see. So obviously, if I'm reading about rugby and you're talking about women players, I'm not that necessarily worried about the language you're using because I'm already invested in listening and talking about and finding out about rugby. But when we are talking to an audience that we want to attract into the game, does the language need to change to make it and I'm going to use the word feminine in order to say to draw people in, but maybe it doesn't need to be that. Maybe the people there are saying, I don't need to know this bit, but I just need to know this, this, and this. Where do you think we're going with that? Or are we already there with the right sort of language?
I think for me, I try not kind of force it too much, because I don't think there's any point in trying to, force women's sport upon someone who might not necessarily want to watch it. I think what makes women's sport interesting, and particularly in the case of women's rugby, is, the athletes are the talent. The athletes are the ones who are going to shine through. They're the ones who make my job easy, and I just have to write around them. For me, I just don't think we should kind of deliberately try and differentiate too much where there doesn't need to be differentiation. So, you look at the England men's team, the England women's team, they're essentially the same, bar gender, and I would treat a match report, to be honest, in the same way that I would whether it's women's rugby I'm covering or men's rugby.
So match
I think
reports are important,
that's
and we get
interesting.
those. But also, obviously, you're very heavily involved in feature writing as well, which is a key part of generating interest around the game. Because when people watch a game, they'll often watch it for lots of different reasons. But often, they will be wanting to check out their favorite couple of players. Who's your favorite player? And they will say Ellie Cadun, Sarah Byrne, or these people that the they will be wanting to be invested in. How do you bring them to life in a way which isn't patronizing, which celebrates what they're about, and the sort of language we should know? And I ask this question as somebody who is always keen to be using the right language at the right time and authentically.
Wow, I mean, yeah, Sarah Byrne is probably one of my pl favorite players to watch, and I'm
Well,
gutted
there we
that.
are. So let's talk about Sarah Byrne. How do we bring her authentically to the audience, which celebrates her as a player in the right way, with sort of almost saying that, why should we be watching her particularly?
Yeah. Well, if you take someone like Sarah Byrne, like she's such an unconventional tight head prop that I don't think we've ever seen the likes of before in the men's game. So I don't know if you watched last year's Women's Six Nations, but there were times when she just, like, literally, she was like a forwards in a back's body, hugging the touchline and going on all these glitzy runs down the wing. And it's, yeah, that was quite a unique, I guess she's quite a unique case study whereby, how do you promote someone like her? And in fact, you've just reminded me. I was flying home from Parma. It must have been 2 years ago now. On when I was went out to cover England. Well, it would have been Italy, England in the Women's Six Nations, and it was that game where Sarah Byrne had scored an absolute worldie of a try. Like, she blitzed down the wing. She shouldn't have been allowed to do it. And I was sitting next to a guy on the plane home, and he wasn't Italian and he wasn't English. I can't remember what country he was from. But we got chatting, and I told him, where I'd been and what I'd been covering for work, and I showed him a photo of Sunday's Daily Telegraph, and there was a big picture of Sarah Byrne in it. It's quite an iconic photo of her kind of huffing and puffing down the wing, en route to scoring this amazing try. And this guy just said to me, "Oh, well," he just laughs. He just laughed at this photo of Sarah Byrne. And I said, "Why are you laughing? Like, this is sheer athleticism, and this is a brilliant show of what women's sport is about, and what the Red Roses are about." And I mean, to be fair, I don't think he'd come from a rugby background, so he didn't quite have the same appreciation as a traditional rugby fan would, I guess. But that really made me kind of not angry, but it really kind of, ground my gears. Do you know what I mean? Because he couldn't look at this photo and appreciate this athlete for who she was, in full flight, about to score a try, busting a gut for our country. And I do think this is where women's rugby, I think, faces an additional challenge compared to the likes of women's football, where, generally speaking, the athletes are a lot more, I don't know if svelte looking is the right word, or they're less big. Their body physiques are sort of more, oh, they have been more generally accepted, shall we say, among a male audience. Whereas women, in rugby have, they're always getting kind of picked apart for how they look, and how big their muscles are and things like that. And Sarah Byrne is no different. She's a 100 kg tight head. Not so long ago, women's game, what they weren't, women's rugby wasn't even seeing 100 kg tight heads. But due to the strength and conditioning resources that are now in top level women's rugby, these women are able to be those weights, but also perform, and it's not hindering their ability at all. So yeah, it's sort of interesting. I don't know whether that answers your question. So I've just waffled there on how amazing Sarah.
No, it's a interesting waffle and insight, really into. I think the thing which comes out jumps out at me there is that we have this sort of magazine idea of what a woman looks like, and every fashion clothes advert will have somebody looking a certain way, but actually, in society, men and women are all shapes and sizes, and sport can allow people to be all shapes and sizes in certain sports. So why worry about it, and why fuss about it if they're still athletic and achieve it? And that's important. So I just sort of interesting then to think about sport in general and how sport moves forward. And is it up to the women in sport themselves to drive the strength of women's sport, or is it up to men in sport to say, actually, we've got to make more of an effort? Who comes first? And I suppose I'm rather rounding to the question: is it up to the governing bodies in the sport to grow the sport, or can it come from underneath? Can it come from people really wanting to make a change at grassroots and make that difference?
I think it can happen from both ends of the spectrum. So if we start from the top down, we know that the majority of people who still work at the top end of rugby are men. Women, the number of women around the table in boardrooms is increasing, but probably not increasing fast enough, as I would like anyway. But if we look at the example of the Rugby Football Union, the RFU, and what they've done for the Red Roses over the past, 4 to 5 years, since that first flurry of full-time contracts for the women's 15s players came in 2019. We can even argue, I guess, that women's rugby, and that the Red Roses team in particular, are in, they've made so many strides, in that short space of time. And I don't know if you watched the Red Roses France Grand Slam finale last year at Twickenham, with the record-breaking crowd to the stadium. I was there that day. The stadium, it was just shy of 60,000 spectators they pulled in, so Twickenham wasn't even full. And the latest RFU annual report showed that game, that standalone match, pulled in £1 million for the RFU in profit. So that tells you that we're at the start of this journey. I know I've referenced women's football a few times on the pod already, but women's rugby is in a totally different commercial space at the moment to where women's football is, and the kind of millions that we're already seeing, in that sport. I guess, I mean, for all their faults, the RFU do deserve massive credit for the way in which they have marketed the Red Roses team as a brand. You know, they have this moniker, the Red Roses, like the Lionesses, that people connect with. And I must admit, I was a bit cynical at the start, like 5, 6 years ago, say, when they rebranded, I think, as the Red Roses. You know, I remember thinking, why can't they just be called the England women's team? Like the England men's team, But the more the term is thrown about and used, it's really interesting how it has sort of really brilliantly fostered this identity, and it allows people, or has allowed people, to connect with this team, who are a team in their own right. Again, very similar to what the FA have done with the Lionesses. More people know the England women's team as the Lionesses now than the England women's football team. And that these monikers are their sort of points of difference, aren't they, in women's sport compared to men, I would say.
So yeah, so picking up on that points of difference then, and sometimes you will see somebody saying the most capped prop of all time, and then somebody then saying, well, not they're not actually the most capped prop of all time. This is the most capped prop of all time, and they will reference a women player as opposed to a men's player. Now, how should we deal with that? Because you can almost see both sides of it. Well, they're separate sports, but it's also important to recognize that Rocky Clark has achieved an enormous amount in the game. So how do we navigate that in a way which is positive for everybody and get the right language about, say, caps and differentiating between England men's and England women's, but also seeing that they're both enormous achievements if you do reach those cap levels.
Well, I'm a massive fan of differentiating with the simple terms of men and women in all sorts of press releases, match day programs, my articles that I write. It doesn't take a lot of effort, right, to stick one word in there, and it subconsciously just plays into a reader's mind that, oh, she's talking about women. Like, yeah, women do play rugby. Or even, if they're reading about, the third most England men's caps player of all time, it's a very subtle reminder that, there are two genders that play this sport. And in fact, women, we know through data released by World Rugby last year that they are a major growth area of the sport, for if not the most popular growth area at this moment in time. And it's so easy. I was at Saracens the other week at a men's Champions Cup game, and oh, that's a good example, actually. If I was to write the Champions Cup in copy, there is no women's version of the Champions Cup, so we don't need to differentiate that it's men, because it's just the Champions Cup. But anyway, I was at Sonics the other week, and I was flicking through their match day program, and I was very, very impressed with Saracens as a club. And there was ample references to the Saracens women's team throughout the program, even though it was obviously a European men's fixture. And I think that's where we need to encourage everyone to get to. Even with work that I file, I'm very diligent about, if I mention Red Roses head coach John Mitchell, the reader will automatically know and assume that the piece they're about to read is going to be about women's rugby and the England women's team, not the England men. So we don't need to, litter it with all these unnecessary references that it's about women. So it's just stuff like that. And I think I was quite infused when World Rugby came out and said it's going to be called the Women's World Cup, or the Men's World, or sorry, it was the Rugby World Cup, wasn't it? They removed the whole gender term, but now they've kind of they've done a U-turn, and they've gone back and calling it the Men's and Women's World Cup, which I don't know, is that the way to go? It's hard, isn't it? But I think for me, when you're writing copy and reading about rugby players, it is so important to differentiate and honour people like, the likes of Rocky Clark, who hit all those caps a number of years ago, and are sort of, trailblazers in their own right, and don't deserve to be forgotten.
Okay, and I think what the interesting thing there is how quickly and quite easily it's very you should just become comfortable with differentiating straight away, and then we're just talking about athletes in this in this area as opposed to trying to, as you say, tiptoe around it. Let's just get to it. That seems to me to be the best way. Now, I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about the media reach here, and anyone who coaches, say, under 13s team, if they asked on a Monday morning, did you watch a match? And this is a boys' team. If did you watch the match over the weekend, or any rugby? And most of them will say no. They won't read the papers. They won't probably watch anything, or follow any sports news. So I suppose it's for all genders, but in for how do we reach the under 13, under 14 to sort of tell them about rugby? And if the boys aren't watching it, how are we going to reach the girls?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because if you look at teenagers these days, they're just surrounded by screens, aren't they? And social media, and they're probably not that interested in reading up on, or watching professional sport. I guess at that age, it's tricky, isn't it? Because for them, and I remember, I'm speaking from my own experience here, but playing sport at that age is such a real outlet, isn't it? For everything that you're trying to navigate as a teenager, whether it's the hormonal changes or pressure at school or whatever it might be, I guess we've seen there's so it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Social media with the likes of all the negative negativity around it, but also you look at things like TikTok and Instagram. Well, let's face it, teenagers are on. Is that how you reach them? I know that from a Telegraph perspective, we have our own TikTok channels because we've identified as a paper. That's how you have to reach the 16 to 25 year olds these days, because everyone's on TikTok. I'm not, because I can't be asked to deal with another app and on my phone to get addicted to. It is the same for women as well, because you hear so many times, oh, why are we investing so much in women's sport when women and girls don't even watch women's sport? Well, they do watch women's sport. It's just, I guess, that age group, I suppose the challenge is that they consume sport in a different way, don't they? To, me and you.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did England get 60,000 into Twickenham? What drove that?
I guess. You're looking at that as an isolated case. We know the audience makeup of women's sport. It's generally 50-50, but it's a lot more family based. And I was there that day. The atmosphere was insane. It was very like it was such a family. It was such a platonic feel to the audience, to the crowd that was there. There was no rowdiness. There was no. It was just nice. It was just so convivial and joyful, and that's obviously we know that the tickets for that game, as they will be for the Red Roses Island game that Twickenham is hosting this year in the Women's Six Nations, they're a hell of a lot cheaper than what you're paying to watching the men, right, at Twickenham. And that's obviously another big incentive for women especially to go along. They had the Sugar Babes there, didn't they? Which, say what you like about Sugar Babes, I thought they were immense, blast from the past. But it's about, I think rugby stakeholders and authorities have woken up to the idea that you need to package women's sport around a particular thing. And I'm not saying the day wouldn't have raked in as many spectators as it did if the Sugar Babes weren't playing there, but that it needs to be a kind of full scale event. That party atmosphere.
Bit like what Harlequins are doing with some of their big games.
Yeah,
They've
massively.
seen them absolutely. I mean, the people who go say they've had a fantastic time. And I'm asked about the rugby, and sometimes the rugby is, well, generally Harlequins play some attractive rugby, but the rugby is just only a small part of the whole experience.
Yeah, and very similar to what cricket have done in the 100 as well. I was a fortune. I've been to a few 100 games, and they've the DJ likes feel, is just it's really cool, and it is cricket trying to remarket itself, right? And that's something that rugby has faced, hasn't it? rugby has this challenge to remarket itself and appeal to that younger generation that, you know, many people say it's losing. So yeah, I don't know if that solved your under 13
Well,
team corner.
I mean, I just wonder from what you're saying is whether we need to chase the things that we can actually make a difference to, and the under 13s kids. I mean, rugby's just not going to pop up on television. I mean, I don't know how much they are able to watch football. Maybe they're just playing football on FIFA and that's it. So I just guess going back to a question. I know that you were. Not necessarily saying you were going to be the expert on, but you certainly will have faced this because you've faced people who've criticized what you've written and why you've written it. We know that when we watch sport, there are some good commentators and bad commentators. We have opinions on what they say. And certainly in football, very recently, there's been some pretty horrendous comments about female commentators, which are completely out of order. But from your point of view, because you are involved in writing about sport but also listening to it, what makes good commentators stand out from the ones which are just not up to the job? I mean, and I'm not saying that as an expert, because you're not in the commentary game necessarily. What for you is when you're listening, thinking, yeah, I like that. This is speaking to me.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I'm no commentator myself, and I take my hat off to anyone who gets behind the mic and gives it a crack, because it sounds hard, doesn't it? I couldn't do it. I like hiding behind a keyboard.
I couldn't pronounce the names, let alone be able to say anything
There
useful
is
about
that.
the rugby.
There is that as well. When I was at the Men's World Cup last year, I was what game was it? Scotland, Romania, I went to, and I went into the press room, and Rocky Clark was there, and Rocky's at the start of her sort of media kind of career, and she was there with a big list of Romanian surnames in front of her, and I was like, God, rather you than me. I think she got through it though. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think commentary is something that obviously takes time to build. You know, practice makes perfect, just like with any sort of, you know, job in any walk of life, right? And it hugely saddens me when, you know, I see, you know, women pundits and female commentators, you know, who, let's face it, have to do they do their homework, they do their due diligence before a rugby game. They have to do their preps, otherwise, you know, they're just up there, and they're such easy targets, aren't they? You know, they're working in a sport, let's face it, which many still perceive as inherently male. And it can be, yeah, it's hard. It can be hard because, you know, as a woman, I suspect, you know, you kind of stick out like a sore thumb a bit. But that is absolutely not to say that they shouldn't be doing it or they shouldn't try. Like we identified earlier, there were more active women's rugby players, or the growth of active women's rugby players that are registered to kind of clubs grew by over a third last year compared to, you know, the male community population, and those are figures of, you know, that World Rugby released prior to the Men's World Cup in France. And it goes back to that old kind of adage, doesn't it, that, you know, you have to see it to be it. And, you know, if we've identified women as a major growth area for the sport, why wouldn't we expect to see? Why is it such a surprise that we're seeing women in the commentary box, or women in the media gantry, or, you know, women around the business table making decisions? You know, it's just a reflection of how the sport is growing and becoming more inclusive. And
Okay,
in terms
so I think that's okay. That is a good political answer. What I want to know is what makes someone stand out as a good commentator for you? When you are listening in, you're thinking, yeah, I'm leaning into what they're saying. This is really helping me. Says, I mean, and from what you've said, I mean, these are what you said before is important, but I want to sort of make sure that when I'm tuning in, I'm thinking, yeah, this person's actually talking sense. I want to hear more of them. For you, what makes the difference?
I guess someone who knows their stats, who's done their research, who can tell me X, Y, Z about this particular player. but who also allows the kind of spectacle to cut through. You know, when a try is scored, they don't necessarily have to talk and talk and talk. And yeah, just allow the action to speak to you through what you're seeing on the screen. I
So
guess
not
that's
too
what
much
I'm saying.
hyperbolic comment. I mean, I suppose what where I come from sometimes is they're saying, oh, how fantastic, amazing, when someone's done something quite ordinary, which good players would do normally, and it's almost to say, wow, look at them. But actually, this is their bread and butter play. So now Sarah Byrne will do some amazing things, but she'll do some bread and butter thing, make tackles, win scrums. How do we make that normal without trying to make, oh, look at this player, aren't they wonderful? Well, they've done some wonderful things, but they've also done some very the good things which make the team function.
I mean, I think the additional challenge that commentators have, whether you're male or female, when it comes to commentating on the women's game specifically, is that, you know, you have your time slot in which to promote women's rugby as much as possible. So, you know, I'll watch the Red Roses on TV, and you know, it is littered with context and a lot of and lots of context, and it might feel sometimes that the commentator is perhaps speaking too much. But for a newcomer who's just switched on the TV for the first time and has never watched a women's game of rugby in his life, you know, that context is important. Now, you're not necessarily going to get that all the time when you're watching, you know, men's rugby, because generally the coverage is more out there. People already know, you know, how many kind of caps George Ford has got for his country, or how many drop goals that he's kicked this season, or whatever it might be. But that additional context is important for when you're trying to reach new audiences and rope in fans and make them want to stay and ultimately get more eyeballs on the sport. I
So
think,
from
you know,
your point of view
yeah,
then,
sorry,
so I
it's,
think that's so that I absolutely it's almost got to go a little step ahead to draw in. Recently I've been watching some of the international netball, and I just love it for lots of different reasons, and I find the commentary has been really good. Is there where can rugby learn from some of the, I mean, obviously I've thrown in netball, what can rugby learn from other sports to sort of make it to improve the its output at the moment?
I mean, you're seeing, I mean, I'm going to talk from a women's perspective, but there are some great women's co-coms that we're seeing cut through at the moment in women's rugby now that the likes of PWR is on TNT. Shona Lee Crapp, the former Welsh captain, is one of them. I think she's really, really good behind the mic. She's very, very balanced in her assessments. Kat Merchant as well is another one who I hope she'll be doing a lot of women's Six Nations stuff this year. And Mo Hunt, the England scrum half, who has spent a fair bit of time in the press box as well, you know, and their rugby understanding is their rugby IQ is just off the scale, and you see it with someone like Emily Scarrett as well. And that's where sorry, I've got postman outside my house, and I think he's going to knock on the door in a minute, but I'm going to carry on what I'm saying. That's where I think it's so easy to, like, you know, showcase personalities and expertise from the women's game and use them alongside, you know, experienced and respected commentators. I mean, it's not going to happen all the time because commentary isn't for everyone, obviously. I've been pleasantly surprised by the kind of influx of current and former international players that we're seeing in the women's game get behind the mic and more than give it a go, but be really good at it.
Yeah, and also I don't certainly the Siobhan is certainly not afraid to say what she feels, having coached her a little bit in
Right.
time, and that's great, because sometimes I think that the difficulty is it becomes a bit sugar coated, and if you're too close to your former colleagues, you can not sometimes say it as it is. I'm not being overcritical, but maybe saying they could have done this or they could have done that, and I suppose that would be different. So if you just to finish off on that, then are there other sports that you like? Oh yeah, I love rugby, but I also really love this sport, because what sports at the moment are really moving forward at pace, or is it just rugby, rugby, rugby?
God, what a question. I mean, I have been doing lots of rugby recently. So I'm a bit of a closed shop at the minute. I covered the Women's Ashes for the first time last year, which was really cool because I wasn't traditionally, I never grew up with cricket. It wasn't something that was on in my household. But my word, seeing some of those athletes up close and just what they're capable of was really, really eye-opening. And the way the whole Ashes was sort of, I think everyone was expecting England to just flop against this really domineering Australia team and for the series to be drawn. And
So what's cricket doing well then in terms of you're watching it and you're thinking, wow, you know, we could use parts of this for rugby and or vice versa.
I guess I think that like again, it's just about kind of showcasing the athletes, showcasing the talent as much as possible, allowing them to speak, and you know that their personalities really kind of came across in the press room, kind of you know post match, and it's interesting because I just think that we are on the kind of cusp of a wave when it comes to women's sport. We've just dipped our toe in it. We're nowhere near to kind of where it's going to go over the next 5, 10 years. I mean, I don't know if you saw, but Deloitte predicted that women's elite sport is expected to reach over or make over like £1 billion this year for the first time ever. And that's massive. That's testimony to where it is going. I'm just trying to think, you know, I'm glad you like the netball. Who were the commentators, by the way, on the netball that you were really wowed by?
I can't now. I'm hopeless with names anyway, and they're probably household names. But I just felt that they what they did very well is they captured the excitement of what was going on, and they also sort of gave some context to what people were saying and why things were happening. But afterwards, I just felt that there was a lot of, as you said, it was very joyful. They were just. They loved the sport. They loved the competition. They loved each other's company. And also, they were very competitive. There were moments where you could see, and they highlight it, where the England goal shooter, whose name I can't remember, and the goal defence, they were having a right old ding dong. And it was fantastic. But afterwards, like rugby, it was almost imagining, right, we just knocked seven bells out of each, but let's share a pint and have a chat about it. And that spoke to me as this is sport, this is great, this is what we're all involved in. And they've just really, they look like this has really enjoyed it. But the main thing for me, I suppose, and that's me talking a bit here, the main thing for me, they didn't have a go at the officials. It was not one, and the officials were making tight calls the whole time. Was that contact or not? Well, I mean, the officials just made that decision, and certainly in netball, it's crucial because the ball doesn't turn over that often at international level. And yeah, that's why I enjoyed it, and that's why I'm interested to know whether rugby needs to look in on that and say, right, we're doing a good job, but we could take something from here, or are they doing a good enough job? So. That's what I was feeling from that.
Oh, I'm so glad you enjoyed the netball. That's really cool. I mean, yeah, if you look at what, you know, the top women's flight has done this year, PWR, in terms of that big campaign that they produced at the start of the season, and you know, powered differently was their slogan. You know, they're trying to get across that message that women are wired differently to men, and it's those sort of female differences that deserve to be celebrated and bigged up as much as possible.
So what are those female differences then?
I don't think you have to overthink it. I just think it's, you know, if you look at women, how the women's game is played, there's less kicking. Some might say that's really good, considering that, you know, kick tennis and men's rugby can bore people to death. There's more running, there's more ball in play time. And you know, there's more. It's just a different spectacle, isn't it? And that makes it female in itself, just by way of design. And there's this argument that, oh, should women kick more? We know that due to physiological differences, they don't kick or can't kick as far as men. That's not to say that we never see 50-22s, because of course we see them, they do happen. But it's those differences that are like, well, this is the sport. Let's appreciate it for what it is. Let's not try and be like the men's when we don't necessarily have to. Let's not follow this kind of design because it's not, you know, it's not, it's not, we don't have to do it basically. So, yeah, sorry, I've just gone off another waffle there.
No. Well, I think that it's the passion to see the difference and enjoy the sport. And I suppose that's why I asked the question a bit earlier on, is it women who should drive the sport forward, or is it the national governing bodies of the sport? And it just strikes me, and this is from where I sit, is the as you say, the PWR of saying, you know, this we're celebrating the way that we want to play. And it doesn't necessarily need someone to come in and say these, as you say, and don't overthink the differences, which is important.
Yeah, and just going back to your point about, I know we spoke earlier about whose responsibility is it to drive the sport, and I started talking about those at the top, but I mean compared to those at the bottom, and that you've got the players themselves who I think from a women's perspective these days are getting more of a voice. So I don't know if you remember last year I covered the, you know, why England's WXV warm-up games weren't being shown on TV. So it turned out the BBC had been offered the rights for free and had turned them down. And that caused a bit of a kind of stir, shall we say, in the sort of women's rugby world. And I remember asking Marley Packer about it, whether she agreed that, you know, whether she was happy that that these games were being shown by the RFU on a live stream rather than a main broadcaster. And to her credit, she came out and said, "Yeah, no, I'm disappointed. You know, I'm not gonna lie. I'm disappointed that they're not being shown on TV." And I was like, "Phew, good for you." Because the worst thing that I think she could have said is, "Oh yeah, we're so grateful that we're being shown on a live stream." And it's those sorts of moments where, you know, you kind of want the players to sort of, you know, seize that initiative. And, you know, it takes a lot of guts to put your head above the parapet when you're effectively, you know, not calling out your employee. Because in this case, I think the RFU had done everything they could to try and get the game on TV, you know, to really take a stand and be like, this isn't good enough. So, you know, that's where, from a player perspective, we are sort of seeing, you know, women trying to influence change in the ways that they can when it comes to the decisions that people are making elsewhere in the game.
Well, I think you might be one of the influencers yourself, especially if you give the chances for people like Marley to have a voice. So, and it's nice, I suppose, given that you are reflecting other people's voices, that you also have a voice yourself in the game. So we're going to finish on that note, and it's been very enjoyable. And I know we've sort of we've touched on subjects, and then you call it rambled off or waffled off, but we've covered a lot of key things. And I think hopefully people can reflect back and think, yeah, it's not straightforward to navigate it in a sense, because there are so many things and barriers which have been put up in the past. So, Fee, thank you very much for rambling and waffling
You're very
to
welcome.
me.
You've got a cereal waffler on you. I'm sorry.
Well, that's because you have to write such tight copy all the time that
I
you're
know
allowed to.
this is peaceful for me. I can just say what
Yeah.
I want and just go on and
Yeah,
on. Your worst nightmare.
that's right. Well, I'll write the headline, remember. So just watch out for that.
Cool.
So you've been listening to a Rugby Coach Weekly podcast with me, Dan Cottrell. If you want to find out more about the podcast, go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the podcast button to find out more about this podcast and all the other podcasts. But for you, thank you very much for your time and your candor.
You're more than welcome. Lovely to connect.
And we look forward to speaking to you all very soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. If you want to hear more podcasts, head over to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the blogs tab to catch up on any episodes you've missed. We look forward to speaking to you again soon with more insights from coaches and experts from the world of rugby, sport, and learning.